We have programs across the Bay Area making sure that live music, which, as we've discussed all morning, is medicine that we need. Live music is accessible to folks who are the most needing of medicine in our world. So we're thinking children in public schools, incarcerated folks, institutionalized folks in care centers, elders.
Welcome to Voices of the Community, your insight into the critical issues shaping Northern California's arts and culture landscape. In this episode, part of our second season, we're showcasing highlights from the second annual California Arts and Culture Summit brought to you by our partner, California for the Arts. This year's theme, Artwork is Real Work, emphasizes the undeniable impact artists have on our economy and well-being. Yet many continue to face challenges in gaining the support they deserve. In today's episode, we'll take an in-depth look at the future of employment in the creative economy. Our esteemed panel, moderated by Narit Siegel-Smith from the Music Forward Foundation, will explore the key trends influencing creative jobs, from the rise of new technologies and the effects of climate change to innovation and shifting workforce dynamics. You'll hear about strategies to build a sustainable creative workforce and the essential skills that will shape the industry's future. Stay tuned as we uncover ways to forge a brighter, more resilient future for the creative economy right here on Voices of the Community.
All right, here we go.
Woo! All right. So, as I was saying, this is the organic start to our organic conversation. We want this to flow. We want this to feel different than the conversations. We want you guys to ask questions. We're going to carve out some dedicated time at the end. As we met, that felt really right to this panel to make sure that this is a dialogue and a conversation, because what we're going to be talking about today is the future of employment in the creative economy, exploring evolving job dynamics and trends, and the impact of technology, climate, and innovation on our sector. This is a spectacular group. I think all of these panels have been made and loaded with some remarkable folks, and I was blown away by that first introductory conversation that we had. So I look forward to you guys getting to know these folks. And I think we have on the panel the person that flew the farthest to get here. So this is Jamie from New York, and you'll get to meet her a little bit too as well. All right. With that, I would love to take it starting here. And we haven't, I mean, you see our names here, but maybe tell us your name, your organization. Right, Tiara, and what your organization, company, city department does. And we'll just go right down the row, starting with you.
Hey, everyone. My name is Tiara Amar. I am the Director of Advocacy and Fellowships at Whippoorwill Arts. Whippoorwill Arts is a Bay Area-based organization focused on reimagining the live music ecosystem. So that means we're musician-centered, working musician-centered, and really focused on what we can do as an organization to make the livelihoods of working musicians, especially in the Bay Area, sustainable, give them meaningful work, and make sure that they have time for their creative practice. We have programs across the Bay Area making sure that live music, which, as we've discussed all morning, is medicine that we need. Live music is accessible to folks who are the most needing of medicine in our world. So we're thinking children in public schools, incarcerated folks, institutionalized folks in care centers, elders. And we also have our advocacy program, which is what more in alignment with what I'm here to talk about, which we just in the past 6 months wrote and released recommendations on ethical pay and professional protections for working musicians, for funders, organizations, legislators who want to engage ethically in the music ecosystem and work with us to reimagine what it looks like.
Thank you, Tiara. Jamie.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jamie Hand. I am here, as we heard, from New York State. I work for an organization called Creatives Rebuild New York. And that is it's always shocking when I say this number out loud, $125 million investment directly in artists. We were born out of the pandemic. It's private philanthropy funded. And we operate two primary programs. One is a guaranteed income program for 2,400 artists across the state of New York. And the other is an artist employment program for 300 artists across the state of New York, working in collaboration with community-based organizations. I am the Director of Strategic Impact and Narrative Change, which is a fancy way of saying research and communications and policy. We believe in those things all being wrapped together, as we've heard is happening here in California, in the work of Julie and her team. And so we realized, again, it was born out of the pandemic as a relief effort, but as a 3-year time-bound organization, we realized pretty quickly it's wonderful to provide that direct relief. It's really important, but unless we're doing longer-term sustainability, systems change, and advocacy work for this to stick, either in the public sector or through other investments, I don't want to say what was the point because there's been a lot of tremendous impacts, but we have to be thinking about that long term because the conditions that came up that made this necessary aren't going away and they've always been there. So I'll leave it at that. There's a lot more to say about how we do our work. But
excellent.
Thanks.
Nicole.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hendricks. I'm the executive director of the Brick Foundation. We focus on getting women and people from historically excluded groups into entertainment, media, and tech. We do that in multiple ways. We work with K-12 to make sure that students are getting access to industry knowledge and education early. We also have the first registered apprenticeship program for animation, visual effects, and gaming. Focuses on career paths like concept art, storyboarding, animation, modeling, rigging, game design, and production management. We also have an industry think tank. We really like to focus on connecting educators, government, and industry together in order to improve those employment pathways. I'm also the co-founder of the Concept Art Association, which is an advocacy organization for artists working in entertainment. About 2 years ago, we got really thrust into advocating for artists with the rise of generative AI. And so that's kind of, I'm wearing both hats here today with y'all.
Brilliant. Take us home, Marcus.
Cool. Hi, I'm Marcus Mitchell. I'm a public art administrator at the City of West Hollywood. We're a small and mighty division in a small and mighty city. The City of West Hollywood Arts Division manages grants programs, grants opportunities across genres and disciplines. There's the public art program, which there are lots of different threads and opportunities there. And we also do grants, public art programming, and we have a great music festival program that happens every year. So yeah, I think just a little background, or no, we'll go. Sorry.
All right. I'd love you to start coming back down this line again for you guys to get to know these folks a little bit more. How long have you been in your field and how long have you identified as an arts advocate?
Awesome. Thank you for the little structure there. I appreciate it. I've been in my field. That's a really interesting way to think about it. My first job in art administration, I was an undergraduate at the University of Southern California studying art history. I think it may be apropos to this panel, but I sent it was through the Getty Multicultural Internship Program. This is back in 2000. So I sent an application for the program and it was late. And Felicia Filer with the Department of Cultural Affairs reached out to me independently of the program. So I've been rejected by the Getty Internship Program. She reached out to me and she said, come downtown. I want to talk to you. And I got an internship through her, which if it was not for that interaction with Felicia Filer, I would not be on the stage. I would not be in art administration. So every interaction that I've had with an artist in the community or a member of the community is because of that chance that Felicia Filer took on me. So I guess that makes
it a great story.
20 years
Amazing.
That I've been in the field.
Amazing. And how long have you identified as an arts advocate?
Oh, that's great. I've never honestly thought of myself as an arts advocate in the sense that I see it when kind of as a dictionary definition. But part of the reason I transitioned into arts administration was I felt a desire to take care of my folks. And I identified with artists and creatives. Yeah. And so in that sense, I kind of see it as a type of advocacy.
Love it. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Nicole, how many years identified as an arts advocate?
So I'm actually a Sac State alum. So it's very nice being in Sacramento. And so I was actually one of the first people from Sac State to graduate with a film degree. So we got to build out that program. And that's when I realized I love building things. And then I had like a long, twisty thing of working in broadcast at CBS 13 locally and then coming down to LA, KTLA. And I was always doing indie films at the side. And then I ended up getting into gaming. And in all of those things, the main thing that it had in common was I was almost always the only female-looking person in the room. I was almost 10 years into my career before I worked with another female as an equal, let alone as a supervisor. And so right around 2018, when a lot of things kind of felt on fire, it just seemed a lot of opportunities presented themselves to try to make more room for people to be at the decision-making tables. I was the only female director at a global gaming company. Just how many, like we never hit above 10 women in a company of almost 1,000 people. So there's just a lot of work that needed to be done and still needs to be done. But I don't think I really identified until COVID because Allison Frenzel, who's a wonderful human, also in Sacramento, she's the CTE program specialist for the California Department of Education, put me onto the COVID task force. So we were trying to help solve that digital divide as all these kids were going home with Chromebooks, none of the software that they need to get into these careers, because everything we do is very career focused, was running on a Chromebook. And that was when I realized that, like, oh, wow, a lot of our public school education is so you need this master's degree in this program, and most of us didn't go to school for these things. So you had like a guy that worked at Disney in the 90s advising an entire school district in 2020 what hardware and software needed to be taught. How is that equitable? And so we were really able to, because of COVID and because people were at home wanting to help and get connected, really help do the new CTE recommendation standards to try to get people with their free and public education to have industry knowledge. And so we had a group of around 60 to 80 industry people come and like rewrite, all, learn as you speak and all the things, right? So it's because it's a different language compared to industry. So I would say probably COVID. And then with the AI stuff, that's when it took a whole new level. So definitely the past 2 years, but I would say 4 proper.
Awesome. Jamie.
What is this field? I guess is how I would start. I'm trained as a landscape designer and came to the arts, I would say, kind of got thrown straight into the fire at the NEA in 2010. So I've been in the arts field for about 14 years and doesn't make sense on paper, but it makes sense to me, the three lines of all those things. And I've done a lot of the cross-sector place-based work that sort of, and I've only recently in my work at Creators Rebuild New York, it makes sense to me because we're doing a lot of cross-sector work with labor and labor policy now. But in terms of being an advocate for the arts and identifying with that, that's relatively new for me, about 2 years.
Excellent. Tiara.
I was raised by a dancer, so I feel like, shout out to the dancers. But yeah, I feel like I was raised to like really understand and witness what the life of a working artist is, the hustle that it is, and all the different hats that you have to wear as a working artist. And that, I feel like that was very formative for me wanting to be in the space of advocacy for artists. I also am a teaching artist at NIAID Art Center, which is a studio space for adult artists with disabilities. And that's been very formative to the core of justice that I see as possible through art. And I am learning so much. You know, I am young and I feel like very lucky to like have been in spaces and with folks I have so much to learn from, but definitely has been a lifetime process of learning to be an arts advocate.
But it's in your DNA, clearly, right? I love it. I know we're speaking to the choir as well, but it's never too late. And I think it's always important to bring more people to the table. I think that as a field, we create that magnetism and stickiness and becoming an advocate along with some of the research and the findings that we're about to share and drop on you guys, but be able to make sure that you're having those conversations in your communities and your networks as well. All right. With that said, as I've mentioned, we are going to be sharing some findings, different city, state, and national projects that have happened and already being teased out in some of the introductions. And without further ado, we're going to start, Tiara, with you. What recent research findings highlight the key trends and shifts in the employment landscape we're seeing inside of the creative economy? So if you can talk a little bit that you're, again, you're coming from that music lens as well, a musician lens, what you're seeing, what some of the research and findings highlight.
Definitely. I think our research has really contributed to concrete ways that we can disrupt some of the mythologies that surround what we think of as being a working musician. We talked about this a little this morning, but there's an idea of like the starving artist, the starving musician that's so glorified, but also the idea of what a working musician does. And our research helped us identify that it's not every musician's aspiration to either be playing in a dirty bar every night or to be selling out stadiums. The vast majority of musicians are seeking something else. And our research identified the top three priorities of working musicians, which is first, guaranteed pay for performance, which is something that's not commonplace in the music ecosystem. The second is consideration of expenses for musicians. So when a musician like goes out to play a gig, how much are they spending on food and lodging and travel in order to get there? Because oftentimes when musicians go on tour, they come back in the hole. And the third thing that we found, which is the highest priority of working musicians, is the ability to play for small listening audiences. And so just because music is a passion for them, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be compensated fairly for their labor. Identifying those top three priorities really helped us form the next four phases of our research project,
the final phase, which we just released, which was the recommendations for ethical pay and professional protections, which includes like research on recommendations for hourly for different pay scales and professional protections that we need. The pay scale piece is that musicians are being paid the same rates that they have been paid since 1985. And if you live somewhere like the Bay Area, that's completely unsustainable. And we've seen a mass exodus of really vital cultural workers from the Bay Area. We also found that 70% of musicians with disabilities face discrimination in the hiring process. 2/3 of them don't report their disabilities and work in unsafe working conditions because of that fear of discrimination. We found that 70% of Black and Brown musicians report discrimination in the hiring process too. And so we really framed our recommendations and our recommendations for pay and professional protections around these like top findings. And we have an hourly rate that we recommend, which is $125 per hour per musician. But the more important piece of that is that we're recommending an hourly rate of pay, which means that musicians who have to spend 9 hours waiting at the gig, traveling to the gig, doing all this stuff, they're recognized for that time, that expense that they're spending to be there. We're also recommending to pay each band member. So if you have a band of 10, you can't, it's not super ethical to pay $500 for a band of 10. So if we want to recognize like each member of the band deserves pay is another really core structural piece of our recommendations. The second part of that is there are so many incredible organizations all over the country that are doing really experimental programs to intervene in this kind of like the struggles that working musicians are facing across the country. And also being really experimental with how people are paying their artists. I think we all agree, like, paying artists is important, but the how is really critical. And so we were able to highlight about 20 organizations across the country that are doing the work of, like, ethical engagement with working artists, reimagining how working musicians do their gigs. How can we get them more gigs? And it's been really cool to see how tied into community engagement that's been and how important it has been in, like, what reimagining the live music ecosystem from going to like something that's like super ticketed, super inaccessible, super, like a club good, to something that like we recognize that people need as medicine, as live music is humanity's oldest ritual. So we really need to make sure that we have access to it.
Love it. And that's at Whippoorwill Arts. The website is amazing. And that research is right there and you can click on it and it tells you for an emerging musician, a more seasoned musician, how to increase it. It's really amazing research. So I love it. Does anybody else want to join in or add to certain trends and shifts you're seeing in the employment landscape?
Can I just add to something, Serge, that Tiara shared? I think we can't overstate how important research like that is to know and to start to understand what it means to work as an artist and what not only what the pay rates and what the pay conditions are, but what your time looks like, what your labor looks like, how much time you're spending in that job versus this job. I think that there's such a lack of data at the federal level, and many folks are part of that conversation about how many artists are even in a place, right? We don't actually know. The reporting is incorrect. And so organizations like Whippoorwill, like Music Workers Alliance, like Dance NYC in New York, like there are organizations, discipline specific, but also increasingly my organization, we had a statewide survey, we had over 13,000 responses, and the amount of information that we're getting from artists about what their lives look like, what their work looks like, I think is really important to changing the conversation.
For sure. As I think we're all hearing, centering the artist in that conversation, not assuming, right, in that. And I think, Nicole, you had to add to this.
So Civil Economics is a great organization. They're economists that their expertise is the creative economy. So with the Animation Guild, Concept Art Association commissioned a study to see what studio heads and executives see the future of AI as it impacts job consolidation and job loss in the creative sector. The results are chilling. I really recommend looking at it. It's feature unscripted. And just, I think it's very clear that we need to advocate to make sure that there's some protections around the human workforce and that companies can't just lay off departments and then just have one artist doing cleanup type of thing, which is what we're seeing happening in Texas. So it's here, it's happening, and we need to really protect our creative community. A lot of the population of artists working in the entertainment industry, these are good jobs. These are 60K to 250K a year roles, health insurance. Some of them are union protected, right? So it's like kind of coming in from the cold versus being a freelance artist. And so we really are seeing a lot of jobs leaving the state, specifically in animation, visual effects, and gaming. Gaming is a $1 billion industry. California needs that revenue. So we're also working with Civil Economics to conduct a study on the pace of those jobs leaving, how much revenue, because again, like artists are not classified appropriately. Almost the entire animation industry is under cartoonists. That's not what they do. And so I think there's a desperate need for like ONET codes to be updated, all kinds of data. But like, our hope is that we're able to fundraise the missing gap we have to really present that we need to have a tax incentive to protect jobs in California.
Love it. Love it. We're going to just pivot slightly to Marcus around some of those emerging opportunities for employment and this word entrepreneurship, right? We, you know, Julie mentioned this earlier, this economy that we're talking about, what's happening today and where we're seeing the growth is in gig workers and independent contractors. So this idea of entrepreneurship is key in talking about the artists and the creative economy. And Marcus, I would love for you to discuss a little bit about those emerging opportunities for employment and entrepreneurship you are seeing from your perspective in city government.
Okay, sure. I can want to get kind of specific here because I'm a public art administrator and I work for a municipal agency. So I'm just going to talk about my experience in my work area. You know, there's entrepreneurship. To me, the constituents is the community of residents in West Hollywood, but for me, it's artists. I serve artists. So I'm going to just focus on that. From an artist perspective, I'm not going to really make a differential between entrepreneurship and or for-profit or nonprofit. If you receive funds to realize a project, I think that's the goal. So as a city worker, we certainly interact with the business community and there are many touch points there, but I want to focus on the artists. And maybe it's because of where I am professionally, just in my day-to-day workspace, but really endeavoring to get the various proposals, our requests for qualifications, requests for proposals, grant opportunities. These are really boring, dry words, but there's money attached to them, right? So that's what entrepreneurship is about. There's really, everyone knows about city bureaucracy, these forms, these processes, these things, but attached to them, there's money. So my job, and I'm realizing this more and more, I've gone through different perspectives on what's important for my job. But in the last year, my focus has really been, we're sitting on these mechanisms that enable access to funds. And there's the equity and conversations about accessibility, but really sitting with what can I do to get these opportunities out there and in front of the right people? And beyond that, how can I help my constituents, the artists that I want to see succeed with these programs? And I don't want to get too deep into it just right now, but there are two things I'm seeing in response to, I think, the question about the future employment, the future opportunities in the arts, and also what, as an art administrator, how we can kind of like go there, support that, is actually, strangely enough, literacy is incredibly important. And I know that doesn't sound like very revelatory, but it's how do you apply to these programs? How do you succeed in applying to these programs in a earlier workspace, a workshop? There's a question of language that was brought up. And that's incredibly important, I think. It's, and that's what I mean by literacy. And I've been spending more and more time on the phone just speaking with artists about literally how do you apply for these opportunities? We're not talking about your art or your vision at this point. It's me on the phone. Could be for 10 to 15 minutes to a half an hour, just explaining the process. And the more time I spend doing on that, the more potential for impact I see there. I spent a ton of money on a degree at an MFA program. I'm still paying the loans back. I could be wrong, but I've participated in very few courses, or I also come from a fairly privileged background as well. And there have been very few opportunities where someone sat down and explained to me how to go through certain processes, whether that's grant writing, evaluations, even reading comprehension. How do you break the thing apart? What are these people looking for? What are they asking for? How do you put a budget together? A real budget. All of these things, these weren't things that I was taught. These aren't things that are really floating around in the industry, so to speak. We talk about a lot of things. These things are boring. But as far as having a successful artist call and one ask me all the time, how do I write a successful proposal? How do I get this money? And it's like, let's go back. Let's look at the instructions. Let's look at the prompts that we've included here and working through making the language more accessible. But there's something beyond that, I think, which, not to chew up too much space, but...
Can we have therapy for a second? Therapy,
go.
I consider myself a reasonably smart human. I come from industry. It took me 2 years to understand how to look at an RERP, a request for proposal, and how to break that down with the programs and work that I do and figure out how to turn it into that. And like, that's with a lot of people behind me. That's a lot of networking. Like, I was able to like beg people to explain it to me. Like, how is somebody, a recent grad, supposed to do that? Like, is there any way we can make this language more accessible?
That's a great question. I don't know if there are any artists in the audience today. Okay, this is great. This has kind of been, not to be corny, this has kind of been on my heart for a little bit. So I know it's 2024 and there are lots of amazing technologies and things like that. And I've lost a little bit of this experience, but call. I'm not joking. Like, okay, I'm an introvert. The reason I went into the arts is because words don't do it for me. I don't like words. I don't trust words. They make me nervous. I'm sure if y'all are artists, like you guys understand what I'm saying. I don't like it, but there's something when call the art administrator or the grant administrator, ask them questions. Ask, that's my job. I am paid by taxpayer dollars to serve the artist community. And just like when you have a leak or a plumbing problem or a noise complaint or whatever activity and you call your city worker and say, hey, do your job. It's the same. If you're a member of the community, which find out who that person is, contact them and ask the questions. I love those conversations because it helps me as an art administrator beyond just doing my job. It gives me clarity as to what are the needs are. What are the artists in my community up to? What are the challenges they're facing? And another thing, just want to say, there are formats for community engagements, and these are wonderful and vital programs. However, they always miss a significant portion of the creative community. In these environments, you're going to get people who have, for whatever reason, have the time, availability, and energy and wherewithal to attend, and who are also confident enough or comfortable enough to kind of dominate those environments. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if that's the only mechanism for you to engage your constituency and community, you're going to miss like 80% of the creative community. You're going to miss the best artists. I don't mean to be, but you are. And creating an alternative kind of backroom channel for folks to call or speak or write or whatever that reaching out mechanism is, qualitatively, it allows for a much deeper kind of dialogue and two-way education process. I've learned so much more about the artists in my community just by folks reaching out and asking questions about some boring, random application process than I have in those large group sessions where we have one or two personalities kind of dominating the situation.
Before we dive into the second half of our expert panel's conversation on the evolving dynamics of creative jobs through new technologies, a changing climate, and a global pandemic that reshaped how we work and create, let's take a moment to acknowledge our generous sponsors who make these discussions possible. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. Before we return to our expert panel's insightful discussion on the future of creative work, take a moment to enjoy an exclusive one-on-one interview with one of our panelists, Jamie Han of Creatives Rebuild New York. Join us to get a deeper perspective on Jamie's personal journey into providing a basic income to artists, emphasizing that the Guaranteed Income Program operates on the principle of trusting artists to know how to best utilize the funds. Stay tuned. This is George Koster with Voices of the Community and Californians for the Arts at the second annual Arts and Culture Summit here in Sacramento. And I have the pleasure of talking with Jamie Han, the Director of Strategic Impact and Narrative Change at Creatives Rebuild New York. So Jamie, my first question would be, I think for the audience, it would be helpful. People call it universal basic income, guaranteeing income. It literally goes all the way back to the people's, you know, it's MLK back in 62. So share with the audience, what does it mean from your perspective?
Sure. Creatives Rebuild New York was born out of the pandemic as a relief program for artists. The Mellon Foundation was involved in a workforce development task force for the state of New York and sort of acknowledged the importance of artists within that, within the landscape and within the possibility of rebuilding New York. The state didn't end up funding it in the budget, so the Mellon Foundation stepped in and did. And we do two programs. One is a guaranteed income program. One is an artist employment program. And our guaranteed income program is for 2,400 artists across the state of New York. What that means is $1,000 a month for 18 months, no strings attached for these artists. I think it's important to note that we designed the program with artists from across the state, as well as some guaranteed income scholars. We called it a think tank, and they helped us sort of make that determination about the $1,000, the 18 months, things like that. But some of the core principles of guaranteed income include the no strings attached aspect and trusting people to know what's best for them, to be able to spend the money as they see fit. And in this case, because it was going to artists, didn't mean that it had to be spent on artistic practice. It could be spent on housing, on rent, on food, on transportation, on whatever those artists need.
And can you share a little bit more about kind of the background? Was there, you know, every jurisdiction likes to do a study about another study so that we can study it and then report it. So how did the city come to a place where they wanted to do guaranteed income? Was there some kind of a study first done, or did people jump in on, you know, Michael Tubbs and the whole activity of Michael Tubbs in Stockton, basically showing, hey, people spend the money to stay alive and get work and, you know, stabilize?
So one first distinction is it's across the state of New York. So 2,400 artists, not just the city of New York, okay, but the state of New York. And the data and the research is there. So we were launched in 2021. And so already the programs in Stockton, as you mentioned, and elsewhere, you know, the broader guaranteed income movement and basic income movement, the explosion of programs and pilots that happened under the ARPA funding from, you know, during the pandemic was a sort of an important baseline for us. We decided explicitly not to make ours a pilot. We weren't doing it for research purposes. We believed that people know best how to spend the money. You know, because we're a private sector, because we're a private philanthropy, we're not public dollars. There's some complexities that come with sort of giving money directly to individuals. But it's permittable through the IRS, but folks had to show that they were below a certain income level, basically. And so we used something called the self-sufficiency standard and people had to sort of verify and show some of their income levels and things like that in order to be eligible. But there was no, you know, for us, it wasn't about, we really were operating kind of from the ideas behind trust-based philanthropy, trusting people to know what they need, to share what they could share in their application. It was a very simple application. Something that I mentioned on stage in the panel was that we tried very hard to center sort of care throughout the process. These are people that are living in dire circumstances. We have statistics from our application data and from our survey data that I think over 60, I think it's 60% of artists are living, are making less than $25,000 a year in New York State, at or below poverty level, right? And so when you're supporting folks through an application process, when you're helping them understand whether getting this money will shift their public benefits, right? Some of these folks are on public benefits. That involves a lot of care, and that involves a lot of what we talk about as social service work, right? And arts administrators aren't often trained or, you know, have the skills to do that. So we had a lot of really important partners in the implementation of that program. And I think I'm veering away from your original question, but we didn't feel like we needed to prove anything. It was, you know, in some ways, when the Mellon Foundation under Elizabeth Alexander's leadership said, you know, this is something that we're going to do for artists. Artists are an important part of the New York State economy. It was, you know, we were set up maybe as demonstration projects. Like, is this a good way to support artists? And so, again, we have the guaranteed income program. In addition to that, we also have an artist employment program. So two different, very different, and sometimes intention methods of supporting artists. And we are doing a lot of research on our programs, right? They weren't done to prove anything, but we do want to know. And so we have two different evaluations happening within the guaranteed income program and two different evaluations happening within the artist employment program that will come out later this year with some information about sort of the models and not just how they use the money, but like what are the ways that artist practices have changed, their overall well-being, things like that.
So I think, you know, from Jimmy, from like an executive summary, if you will, for a moment, because I know you're still doing the study, what would you say are the two big things? One,
your findings that you think kind of are aha moments, and then secondary best practices that you believe have come out of the program?
I think, you know, it's both an aha and not surprise at all, is that artists spend money like everybody else does, right? Major medical expenses that they weren't able to do until they had this, you know, housing, food, again, in the post-pandemic context, we're still in it, but the pandemic context, you know, we did learn from some artists, not through our research, but through some gatherings that we've done and sort of more qualitative and personal interactions with artists. Many felt shame at first that they weren't spending it on their practice, that it wasn't something that they, you know, that they were wasting it because they were using it on rent. They were wasting it because they were using it on food, but they're not, right? And so sort of helping them understand that they are deserving has been one of the main sort of a North Star for us as we've moved through. So again, it's not an aha, but it's actually important to name is that artists spend money like everybody else. And then, gosh, some of the questions that we'll be looking at in the research, as I said, there's two different aspects of the research. One is sort of for the guaranteed income program fitting into the economic justice and guaranteed income sort of policy world. And that's a bunch of researchers and institutions that are deeply entrenched in that and looking at some of the changes in their lives, right? Whether it's related to medical bills or healthcare or, you know, other things that it has enabled for artists. Within the other evaluation, the folks that are sort of steeped in sort of not artist employment, but sort of how artists sustain their careers, they're doing some interesting studies on how the population that we served, the artists that came into us through this eligibility, how that compares and would fare in other states and across the country if you sort of understand what we know about artists in other places. So it's sort of abstract at this moment, but it's like the artists that came into us are not the artists that the federal data says are in New York State, right? And so we're actually surfacing more realities, more stories, or more needs that artists face through this program, and sort of looking at that data and understanding how other states, other places can say, oh, maybe we need to support artists in slightly different ways too. And maybe there's more artists than we realize were here.
So as we wrap up, is there anything that we haven't asked you and that you haven't talked about in the panel that you'd like to make sure that we get out there?
I'll just underscore something that I feel lucky I was able to say on the panel, which is, you know, for us, centering artists has been core to how we've operated as an organization, from the design of the programs to how, as I was saying on the panel, how we are thinking about policy work and policy change and making sure that sort of artists are, you know, not just their experiences and the data about how their impact, you know, the impact of the programs on them, but that they are the voices, they are the folks that are sort of contributing to the advocacy and to the movement around new ways of supporting artists.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for being on Voices of the Community and Californians for the Arts here at the Summit and taking time away from the Summit to share your wonderful insights.
Thank you
really
so much.
Appreciate it. And good
Likewise.
Luck with the program.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Let's continue our exploration into the future of creative work, moderated by Narit Siegel-Smith from the Music Forward Foundation, with panelists Nicole Hendricks from Brick Foundation, Marcus Mitchell, the Public Art Administrator for the City of West Hollywood, along with Tiara Amar of Whippoorwill Arts and Jamie Han from Creatives Rebuilt New York. Up next, they'll address one of the most pressing issues in the creative industry, the persistent undervaluing and underpayment of artists. As the myth of the starving artist continues to limit opportunities, we'll explore how these barriers prevent artists from earning a living wage and what solutions are emerging to change this narrative.
Again, I consider myself a reasonably extroverted human. And those sessions are terrifying. They're not capped. They'll be like, you'll show up to an info session. There's 200 people there. I'm not going to ask a question. Like, is there a way that we can cap and just have a lot of them? Like, so no more than 15 people at a session.
I love this conversation. Well, I think it's important. I think that what you guys are presenting here is exactly what we want to break those barriers between resources and the artists, right? And create simpler application process and go back into conversation and calls and talks and connection between those two. I think it's great. And I want you guys to continue off. But I'm sure that the civic leaders out here understand exactly what is, and the artists understand what this conversation is. But we've been having this for decades. And so we have to definitely keep stripping away at this because we have to strip those barriers. And I would love, Jamie, if you can talk, because I feel like your team in that this 3-year intentional program directed at artists, like talk a little bit about some of those policy wins, some of the learnings that you found, and some of the advocacy that you've seen through this project.
We are just at the beginning relative to what we heard Julie talking about this morning, all of the wins that California, the infrastructure here is more robust than it is in New York State. There's a lot of disparate folks doing advocacy work in New York State. I do have to say one thing to that last, because it's related. First of all, private philanthropy, not just public sector funders, need to be in this conversation too.
Yeah.
And one thing that we very intentionally chose to do from the beginning is we hired artist organizers across the state to get the word out about our funding opportunities. Nobody does it better than
and all different artists from different genres, from different...
And both hiring artists in the process, but also not using the traditional methods of making sure people were aware of this, because we explicitly wanted to support not just the 20% of artists that know how to come to funding opportunities. So in terms of the policy and advocacy work, I mean, the way we're doing it, there's a little bit of a top-down and bottom-up simultaneous approach that needs to happen. That's the world we live in. And so, again, we have 2,400 artists in our guaranteed income program, 300 artists and over 100 organizations in our artist employment program. So making sure that they know the long game, that they understand that just because that program ends doesn't mean the transition support, the offboarding support that my colleagues are providing as we invite artists into the policy work is actually a really important and core part of our values about how the policy change is going to happen. I'd be remiss if I didn't sit on the stage and take the opportunity to talk about the guaranteed income movement in this country, right? Artists talking to artists about it actually doesn't matter as much as artists getting involved in the broader guaranteed income movement and arts organizations, right? There's so much happening and there's so many resources and there's so many people that are willing to and excited to bring artists in to help shape that momentum, to help shape that movement. And artists are actually seen and understood in part because of our program, in part because of Springboards for the Arts program, in part because of YBCA's program, BMAC, an amazing organization in Nashville. There's an understanding that artists are not necessarily special unicorns that deserve guaranteed income more than other humans or other workers, but that we do have a unique set of stories and abilities to convey the experience. And so because we were the only statewide guaranteed income program at the time that we launched, and also in New York, but there's a handful of smaller programs, we helped launch something called the New York State Cash. I think we're calling it the New York State Cash Alliance now. And so that's just bringing, again, nothing. It's not specific to the arts, but it's understanding that if we band together and we include artists in that coalition, in that alliance, we can help move towards policies in New York State that are specifically relevant to cash policy. Sometimes that looks like tax credits. Sometimes that looks like guaranteed income programs.
You know, you guys haven't found that the guaranteed income programs like give leeway to the systems not changing? Like, did you feel like it's saying that even though our systems are broken, we're going to help over here, and it's avoiding the system issues that are keeping our musicians not getting paid?
Well, it's the blessing and the curse of having two different programs that are almost in opposition to each other, right? We have an employment program too. So we're engaging in the realms of benefits, unemployment benefits, insurance issues. All of that is real. And again, it's not just artists that are dealing with this, right? And so the more artists can understand themselves in solidarity with other workers, right? So the Unemployment Bridge Program in New York State is an important one. Portable benefits policies that were just rolled out in Utah as a proposed legislation this week, right? These are the things that artists need to be paying attention to and showing up for and understanding how it affects them and their lives. Mm-hmm. And the more that we can actually create those bridges across, again, across sectors, but making sure that artists are showing up as core to that and showing up as allies in that, I think is really important.
Cool. Any to add to this conversation here?
How can we get involved? We are closing at the end of this year. We're doing a lot of, again, because of our New York State focus, trying to create a lot of resources with transparency about what we've done well and not well in our programs. We just released some process evaluations for both programs, as well as a series of recommendations. We convened working groups of others doing artist employment programs. We had folks from the California Creative Corps. We had folks from a Manny Ober program in Puerto Rico, some city level programs and others, both public and private, talking about artist employment. One win from that is that the NEA is actually now doing a national field scan of artist employment programs to understand sort of the different range and kinds. And so pay attention to that stuff that's coming out. And again, I think if you want to understand the pros and the cons of running your own basic income program or running an employment program, I think our process evaluations would be helpful. We will be making a set of policy recommendations for New York City and state coming out later this summer. And we will be sort of connecting our artists to broader movements in the arts and outside the arts
look at our website. I mean, that's the other thing. Yeah, sign up for our newsletter. We're trying to talk a little bit about what it means to not just be a funding organization or a funder, but to move into this work and make sure that others know how to do that.
I love it. I think, Nicole, you touched on this a bit earlier around AI, generative AI, and technology has definitely been affecting this industry for years, for decades. But we've seen an increase in the past couple of years. And you guys did some research recently that I would love for you to talk a little bit about how this technology is impacting our creative industries.
Sure. I mean, we're living through the greatest art heist of all time. I don't know if y'all are aware of Lion 5B. Lion 5B is 5 billion images and text pairs. It was scraped illegally without your credit consent or compensation. Family photos, art portfolios, inappropriate things, child porn, like name it, it was taken. And then Lion 5B was basically operating under the educational not-for-profit usage. It was funded by Stability AI, and then it flipped to a licensing model, which should be illegal, but they're basically using data laundering, and that is what Midjourney and everything is basically being used off. So when you hear ethical AI and I'm putting in my own images, that's not true, because you need billions and billions of images. The 100 images that you own that you're putting into are still referencing that trained stolen data. And there's really nothing that, like, there's a lot of things in progress to protect us. Adam Schiff just promoted a transparency bill because a lot of these things, it's kind of a black box with what's been stolen. And so definitely, like, we'll look at what's happening with Adam Schiff. He's great. He's wonderful. Conspire Association, a proud supporter of that bill. The Human Artistry Campaign, because the music industry has been through this before with Napster, right? So not now, but with streaming. And so I think that taking a lead from them with the Human Artistry Campaign and seeing the work that they're doing, but also just like what kind of, when you see somebody that's like, oh, I did this with AI. And then I just don't see ethically currently when you're using it and generating images, you're working off the backs of everybody else. And like my husband and all my friends' work is in there. So it just feels very icky for me personally. So whereas, yes, AI might be here and might be here to stay, I think it's really important that we're really focusing on the ethics and we're trying to advocate for ethically obtained data sets.
And it's affecting jobs, right? It's affecting jobs.
Oh, yes.
And the skills needed for those jobs.
100%. If you go to conceptartassociation.com on the advocacy tab, we've been gathering testimonials from the creative sector since January 2023. It is prevalent around the world. People's jobs going away, entire departments getting let go. Most importantly, though, is because a lot of artists are contract employees, work for hire, right? So we're going from gig to gig. And a lot of things that are keeping the lights on is commercial work. Commercials are always shooting. They used to pay really well for design work. Now they're basically showing up with ad agencies being like, hey, here's 100 images I generated off of Midjourney. Make something like that. That work's now gone. Those were hours, billable hours for design. Also similar, independent producers, a lot of pitch packages. That's a lot of work that people were using to keep the lights on year round. That stuff is gone. Independent producers are now just generating their own images for pitch packages, right? So even if we're not seeing like a one-for-one loss, we're seeing percentage of business loss, percentage of livelihood loss. And so I think that's important for us as a community that whereas, yes, we do need to keep in touch, but also like real talk. There's not a lot of learning curve with using AI. People aren't getting left behind with typing in words, right? Like, so it's like, it's not like it's just more about the ethical usage of it. I do think entrepreneurship is the way we should be focusing as we're looking at how many people have lost their jobs the first quarter of the year alone, first month of the year alone. What does that mean, right? I mean, already my generation isn't able to like, I'm going to get a job and I'm going to stay here my whole career. That doesn't exist anymore. And how much longer in this late stage capitalism life that we're living in, right? Like, can we actually rely on a lot of us getting those in-house gigs? And so I think that if anything, the skill I would really be working on is not necessarily AI technology, but can you run your own business? Do you have the soft skills to be able to network? Can you stay on top of things and pivot yourself and reinvent yourself as you need to make a living for your family, doing what you love and whatever lens is getting you employment at the moment?
What other skill sets from this team that to enter the industry? I know you mentioned literacy earlier, to enter, to stay viable. Any other skill sets that you guys are seeing are going to be key in this future economy?
Yeah, this kind of connects to not the AI question, but what we were talking about before. Something that we do is try to think about how we can reach musicians who are typically like kind of left out of some of like the more traditional, like who aren't applying for grants, who aren't like in the top 10% of earners to be getting like high paying gigs, and how we can make their livelihoods a little bit more sustainable through. Okay. So we have a Music Alive program, which essentially provides musicians in the Bay Area with well paying gigs per musician to perform, and they have a regular gig. And because they have a regular gig that they're not every month like striving for, it unlocks their capacity to engage in work outside of gig hunting. So it enables them to engage in their creative work. So finally, they have time to compose. They have time to practice, which they might not have if they're always performing. But what we also found is that when these musicians have their, you know, have a solid gig every month that they can use to pay their rent, it also unlocks their ability to like participate in the more political work of organizing as workers. Yes, to engage them in the advocacy. You know, a lot of conversations that are had in spaces, it's so hard to organize the artists, like the artists won't show up to the workshop. How can we make sure that they're getting the skills? But a lot of it is that if their basic needs are taken care of, artists are actually really interested in the advocacy. They really know that, like, and they're really engaged in wanting to help shape the artistic environment that they contribute to. We've been working with some unions in the Bay Area, Local 6, to make sure that to organize the musicians and get them involved in the process of talking to their city governments about musician pay. There's no municipality in the country that has a pay minimum for musicians' work. And we know that budgets are moral documents. So we have been able to organize the musicians to be able to talk to their elected officials, not because I think we have done something like super incredible, but because a lot of the musicians we work with, their basic needs are just being met. Like they can pay their rent. And so now they have a little bit more capacity to talk to their electeds, to be in their communities and organize themselves. And I feel like that is part of the ecosystem shift that we want to create, is that artists have a lot of the skills that they need to advocate for themselves, but how can we get them the capacity to advocate for themselves?
That's excellent. Awesome. And Jamie, I don't know if you have any.
Would have said the exact same thing. Amazing. I mean, I mentioned a minute ago, centering artists and their power in the ability to achieve policy change. I do think it can borderline be patronizing to assume that artists aren't already doing this, or that they should show up for something that they don't care about, right? I think there's a line to be careful about. But I think Tiara's point about capacity, like creating the space and capacity for artists after their needs are met to be able to show up. Somebody earlier in one of the sessions talked about how artists pay other artists like first, right? That we know that from the data. Yeah. Artists also want to support other artists, right? And so as people are rolling off of our guaranteed income program, they're asking our program team, how can we show up in support of this? How can we make this possible for more artists? How can this be not just this program, but elsewhere? And so they want to know. And I think the only thing I'd add to the way Tiara described it was, be willing to tell your story, right? I think there is some shame associated with poverty in this country, right? But the reality, being able to tell the story about the reality of your lived experience, is one of the most important things for elected officials to hear.
I love it. Having our artists have their voice heard is amazing. And I think that one of the things that I also heard here is making sure that in training, in education, in community, we are teaching artists how to monetize. What are all the different ways, the new ways, the old ways? What are the ways that artists from all different fields can learn how to monetize?
Can I add one more?
Please.
And just because the artists in the room here, I'm sorry, my stuff is super basic. This is so basic, but it's also, it's something I need to know and teach myself, but ask for help. Like I said, all these things need to be in place. If you're an artist or creative, be an artist or creative. You should learn how to create a budget or respond to certain things, but you're not supposed to become an accountant. So in all this, I think this entrepreneurship is cool, but I think you've kind of got a culture of this super hyped up, like mega entrepreneur where you're like some robot brain person who does everything. And like, what is that? So like, but to go back to my point though, like, no, don't become an amazing accountant, but if you don't know how to do a budget, you probably know someone who does, regardless of your background. Our communities are amazing and full of really amazing people with incredible skills. If you have a weakness, find somebody who can help you out. Know your weaknesses. And because that's how these corporations and people on top who project that they know it all are actually doing it. They have a team of like 100 people doing all the little things for them.
And they just, I've seen this even with artist studios. When you look at artists and you're like, whoa, how did they get there? They've got like 50 people working for them. So you, in your situation, working all alone, are not going to be able to generate a corporate level package, but understand what you're missing and what you need. And to the extent that you can, don't be afraid to ask for help. And to go off of what Julie said, you'd be surprised. Like, people want to help you. People want to support you. And if you come to them with something that they can actually give, that's a win. Like, I'm not going to be able to give everything, but if you're asking me something that I have to give, whether it's time or a skill or an ability, you may be surprised how people show up. So don't think it's your job to be, I don't even know the names of all these guys on the covers of like Fast Company and stuff, but don't try to be like that. That's not why we value you. Do you, but just know what you need to succeed and look for that support, because that's what the people who are successful, that's what they're doing.
Love that. No, and something that came up in conversation previously is these great collaboratives of artists that have been popping up, and these communities of artists that are relying on each other, pulling on each other's strengths and skills together. And I think that we've talked at length about those, the partnerships and collaboration today already. I think there's some really great tactical things that this panel has shared with everybody. The thing that I am taking away from already this day and from what was just shared is how important this network is to all of us and to the artists and the creative economy. So keep talking, keep sharing, keep growing together. My name is Nareet. Thank you to California for the Arts for this amazing summit. And thank you all for being here. Thank you, panelists.
Thank you.
As we wrap up this fourth episode of Voices of the Community, featuring insights from the California for the Arts, Arts and Culture Summit, we'd like to express our gratitude to our moderator, Nareet Siegel-Smith from the Music Forward Foundation, and our incredible panelist, Nicole Hendricks from the Brick Foundation, Marcus Mitchell, the Public Art Administrator for the City of West Hollywood, Tiara Amar from Whippoorwill Arts, and Jamie Han from Creatives Rebuild New York. Your journey into their world doesn't end here. Dive deeper at voicesofthecommunity.com, explore full bios, discover the incredible work their organizations do, and find ways to make a difference. It's all under Where Art Meets Impact, then Episode 4, The Future of Creative Work. While you're there, uncover a treasure trove of interviews and stories in our Arts and Culture series. Stay connected through our newsletter, and if you're inspired, consider donating or volunteering. Your support fuels the creative spirit that makes our community so special. Join us next time as another panelist of experts from the California for the Arts, Arts and Culture Summit delve into the crucial conversation around building better bridges in the arts economy through collaborations. Today's episode was made possible through our co-production partnership with California for the Arts at their second annual California Arts and Culture Summit. Special thanks to our technical crew, audio and video wizard Eric Estrada, and our production partner Bayvac Media and their team, Paula Argoni, Andy Konami, Javon Giles, and Clay Go. Thanks to Casey Nance from Citron Studios for the graphics magic. A special thanks to our broadcast partners who help share these important conversations, KSFP-LP-FM in San Francisco, KPCA-LP-FM in Petaluma, Petaluma Community Public Access TV, and Bayvac Media's SF Commons Public Access TV. Thank you for your commitment to amplifying diverse voices and perspectives. Please support these partners and our mission by tuning in and spreading the word. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. And we'd love your support to continue to make shows just like this one. Go to georgecoster.com and click on the donate button. Take Voices of the Community with you on the go. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Enjoying the show? Please rate and review us. It helps more people discover these important stories. Watch past and future episodes on YouTube by searching for Geo Koster. Have feedback or ideas? We'd love to hear from you. Email george@georgekoster.com. I'm George Koster from San Francisco. On behalf of our team, thank you for joining us. Until next time, remember, your voice matters.